welcome to Kazu. And so we will now move into the conversation part, where Ari, our moderator for today, will lead a conversation with Kazu and start off by introducing him, and following which, in about 35 to 40 minutes, we will open it up for all of you, so you can also ask your questions. So thank you, everyone, and over to you, Ari.
Good morning. Well, I'm grateful to be on this phone call with everyone who obviously has the same inquiry or shares an inquiry about creating more peace in themselves and peace in the world. And we have with us a person that I hold in high esteem and very dear, in Kazu Haga. Kazu is a nonviolence trainer, and he's the founder of the East Point Academy in California, which envisions a world where historic conflicts are fully reconciled, where new conflicts arise solely as an opportunity for deeper growth. Kazu began working in this movement of peace at the young age of 17, when he embarked on a year-and-a-half journey across the U.S. and South Asia, studying nonviolence while living in temples, and in Buddhist order, committed to peace and justice. And I have had the opportunity to know Kazu as a grantee through the Pollination Project, and I met him at actually an Awakened Circle over at Casa de Paz in Oakland about a year ago, and I've gotten to learn a little bit about Kingian nonviolence and have benefited greatly from it. And I'm looking forward right now, Kazu, to deepening that conversation with you. And I guess what I would, first of all, I'd like to start the conversation with is, you know, you started this, you know, at a very, very young age. And I'm wondering a little bit about, you know, how did you get involved in nonviolence? What inside of you compelled you to begin this search, this investigation, and brought you to this approach, this life, and this mission of Kingian nonviolence?
Sure. Good morning, everyone, first of all. I just want to say that I'm really grateful and honored to be here. I've been on a couple of these calls myself, and now to be on this side of the call is truly humbling and an honor. So I think for me there's two things that has happened in my life that really put me on the path that I'm on now. You mentioned when I was 17 years old, I actually dropped out of high school when I was 15, and I spent the next couple of years on the streets, involved in a lot of drinking and drugs, and was not living a very productive life. And I think, you know, even though I was telling myself on the surface level that I was having a good time and I was partying and all this, just beneath the surface, I was bored and I was sick of that life, and I was searching for something different. And I always say that, you know, I'm so grateful that what that something ended up being was something positive, because I think at that point in my life, if a military recruiter had met me first, I could have just as easily gone off to war, or any number of things. But when I was 17, I heard about a pilgrimage that was being organized by this Japanese Buddhist order called Nippon Zanmyo Hoji, and it's a Japanese Buddhist order that's very dedicated to peace and justice in the world. And they were going to walk from Massachusetts to New Orleans, and then down the coast of Africa to retrace the slave route, and to talk about the Middle Passage and the legacy of slavery and how it continues to impact this country, and to begin the process of healing and reconciling from that legacy. And, you know, I was 17 years old, had never been involved in any sort of activist causes or anything like that, but for me it was just an opportunity to get out of town and see something new. And so on a whim, I told my friends that I'm just going to go check this out for a week. You know, I was going to walk from my hometown where the walk was starting to Boston, and I come home. And I didn't come home for a year and a half after that. I remember on the third day of the walk, really feeling like that's where I needed to be right now in my life, and ended up walking all the way to New Orleans with the monks. And then one of the nuns from that order took me under her wing and invited me to go to Asia with her. So I ended up spending a year overseas in Nepal and India and Sri Lanka, studying in their temples. And so I was really transformed by that experience. And when I came home, back to the States, I started getting involved in community work and activist work, and spent many, many years involved in various social movements. And then the second thing that happened to me was more recently in 2009. In the fall of 2008, I took my first workshop in Kingian Nonviolence, which is under the tradition of Dr. King. And I really enjoyed it, and I was thinking about everything I learned in that workshop. And then 3 months later, in Oakland, California, a young man named Oscar Grant was shot. And for those that don't know, Oscar Grant was a young man, a 22-year-old father, who was shot in the back and murdered by the transit police here in Oakland on New Year's morning of 2009. So I ended up on the steering committee of the coalition that came together that was organizing a lot of the mobilizations afterwards. And through my experience in that movement, I found that even oftentimes in our movements that are trying to create peace and that are trying to create justice, we can be perpetuating systems of violence and oppression. And that movement, in my perspective, was a movement that was so grounded in anger. And that anger is righteous because we need to be angry about some of the conditions of the world. And at the same time, if we allow anger to be the force that motivates us, it can burn us out really quickly. And there's an old saying that says hating someone is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. And for us, you know, as a movement that was so grounded in hatred towards the police, we started internalizing that hatred and started arguing with each other, and we destroyed that movement from inside out. And so that summer, I really felt the need to look for a different way to create change. And, you know, I was reminded of a quote when Dr. King said that nonviolence isn't just about refusing to shoot your opponent, but it's about refusing to hate your opponent. And so I got trained in nonviolence that summer and have been doing that specific work ever since.
Wow, those are some lofty goals there about nonviolence and seeking not to never to hate your opponent. I'm curious about what does it take internally. What is it taking you to take that on, to love your opponent and to see their humanity, to see the person who shot Oscar Grant, you know, as someone who also suffers.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was having a phone call once with one of the organizers of the Oscar Grant movement during the whole thing, and she called me one day after one of the hearings, and she said, you know, I was in the courtroom, and I saw Johannes Messerli's face, that Johannes Messerli was the police officer that shot him, and she said to me, and when I looked into his eyes, I realized that I don't hate him, that I don't hate this man, and that was one of the most I guess, memorable conversations I had during that entire movement. And I think when you look at Johannes Messerli, who himself was 26 years old, who himself was the father of a six-month-old baby, who himself had his life destroyed by this incident, and his parents were receiving death threats, and the lack of training and support that he was getting from the department. And, I have a friend who used to be a probation officer, and she used to say that during her training, she would come home in tears every single day, because when you go through training in law enforcement, part of what they train you in is the idea that you do whatever you have to do to get home that night. If that means killing somebody, if that means shooting, whatever you have to do, you have to think about yourself first. And there's so much dehumanization that goes on in that. And so I think when you realize, when you try to see things from their perspective and really honor their experience and honor their pain, you know, you can't help but see their humanity. And I think that's what nonviolence really calls on us to do, is to not give up faith in the humanity of any human being, no matter how much harm that they've committed.
So the example you just gave about the probation officer who's does whatever they need to do to come back that day, that seems like skillful in some ways or appropriate response. I'm just wondering, it seems to me that maybe the difference, maybe the Kingian nonviolence or other forms of nonviolence, is that you're building the wisdom for how to come home in a way that allows others to come home as well in a way that's peaceful.
Absolutely.
Would that be an accurate statement?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, there's been a lot of conversation already this morning about conflict, and you know, police officers are professionals who are supposed to be trained to go into conflict situations and try to handle them in a responsible way. And I think part of the problem is that the only tools that they're given are tools that tend to escalate conflict and increases the likelihood of violence. And I, you know, one of my dreams is to train law enforcement In nonviolence and conflict de-escalation, because if anyone needs it, it's people whose job it is to go into situations of conflict. And I think, you know, just like some people have already said this morning, in our philosophy, we don't believe conflict is a bad thing. We believe that conflict itself is completely neutral, and it's how you respond to that conflict that gives it a good or bad outcome. So things like fighting, things like violence, things like arguments, those things aren't conflicts as much as those are things that happen when you mismanage a conflict. So we believe that there's a way to respond to conflict situations using nonviolence that, instead of arguments or violence, results in strengthened relationships and lessons learned. So
you're taking this Kingian nonviolence, which you've been trained in, and you're training other people, and you've obviously been transformed yourself through the process. I'm curious what you see in people whose history, you work in prisons a lot, and there's a history there of using physical violence in many of those cases of people who are in those prisons. And I'm curious, how do they relate to it? And what are they, is it self-selected who comes? Are they forced to go? And the people that come, what allows them to see, coming from a place where violence is such a way to express someone's confidence and someone's capabilities and someone's prowess, how do they transition? And I'm curious how they're different at the end of the training, and how do they do that within an institution that is filled with so much violence around them?
Sure. So the majority of the work that I do right now is with incarcerated populations, and it depends on the institution. Some institutions that we go to, the workshops are mandatory, and some they're voluntary. But there's a lot of, you know, amazing anecdotal stories. I remember one time I was doing a two-day workshop at a women's jail in San Francisco. And in that institution, the workshops were mandatory. And the workshops happened in a very small space where we could barely move around. And some of the women weren't told that they were attending this two-day workshop until about 10 minutes before, when they were waking up out of bed and told that they were going to go to this two-day workshop. It always starts it oftentimes starts in these very tense situations where, in this particular one, some of the women were very vocal about not wanting to be there and telling us, you know, this is BS, I don't want to be here, and this and that. And in that workshop, I remember there was one woman that walked into the room that morning, and I didn't realize this until the end of the training when she told me, but when she walked in, she saw another woman in that room who was from a rival gang, and those two women had been in a conflict that had been escalating over the last several days. And so the moment she walked into that room and she saw that other woman, she told herself, I don't know if I can make it these next 2 days without getting into a fight with this other girl. And apparently the conversations that we were having just in that first day of the training inspired her so much that after we left on the first day, that evening she went and reached out to this other woman, and they were able to reconcile that conflict. And at the second day of the workshop, during our closing circle, she stood up and shared that story with us, and the two women embraced in a hug in the middle of our circle. And so I think, you know, one of the reasons why I love working with incarcerated communities, A, is because nobody understands better the impact that violence has had on our communities than the men and the women in our prison system. You know, sometimes we think of them as, oh, well, they're prisoners, so they don't care about peace, they enjoy violence. And that has not been my experience. I think as human beings, nobody wants violence. I think we all have an inherent desire for peace. And so I think when you go into these communities and offer people an alternative way to deal with conflict, which for many of them is something they've never even thought about, they grab onto it quicker than most people in the community do. And also I think, you know, forever to change the culture of violence that exists in so many communities, especially in low-income urban communities, then it's the people who have been most directly impacted by it that has to be the leaders in creating that cultural change. So, you know, I'm going to keep going into these communities because those are the places where I think is some of the best places to recruit peace warriors.
You know, I'm curious, one of the things that I've heard you talk about is how much training is involved to become a peace warrior. And you talked about how, I think it was something like a decade that Gandhi and his fellow people who trained for the Salt March. And then you talked about the number of months that they trained for Selma to face the oppressors in Selma, Alabama. I'm curious, so like, you know, you have this 2-day workshop you're talking about, and there's this transformation. What after the workshop, you know, those two people, what is the inner work that you suggest they do that allows them to create the peace in themselves? Because in my experience, if I don't know, as another caller who spoke, another person who spoke also said, is that if they're not grounded, and I think there's Kanchan who said it, you know, if they're not grounded in the moment and have peace in themselves, then they tend to see violence around them, and they tend to sow the seeds for violence. So I'm just curious, what's the encouragement there?
Sure. The East Point Peace Academy, the organization that I started, we started it because we acknowledge that changing cultures of violence and transforming them is not an easy task, and it takes significant training. And just as the military trains many of its top leaders at the military academy at West Point, the idea behind East Point Peace Academy is that we're investing heavily in training leaders in the peace movement. And, you know, you had mentioned that the leaders of the Nashville Lunch Counter Sit-In Movement, which are some of the people, the elders that trained me in nonviolence, they trained for a full year before they went to their first protest. And Gandhi and his 78 followers lived in an ashram together and went through a 15-year process of self-purification and training and preparation before embarking on the Salt March. And so our 2-day workshop is really just an introduction. And we always say that it's an introduction to a philosophy that if you want to train yourself in, the training starts at the end of those 2 days. And someone on the call earlier mentioned martial arts. And I'm wondering if he was talking about Aikido, but, you know, in martial arts, you don't take a 2-day martial arts workshop and then you're done with it, right? It's an ongoing, lifelong commitment to improve in the skill every single day with more and more practice. And nonviolence is very similar. You know, at the end of the 2 days, you get a certificate that doesn't say you're nonviolent. It says you participated in a 2-day workshop in nonviolence. And so becoming nonviolent isn't a thing that you become. Like, you know, you don't become kung fu, you don't become karate, you're constantly in the practice of improving as a practitioner in that art. And so after the 2-day workshop in the prisons and in the jails, we work with the men twice a week. This past Thursday, we were doing role plays in de-escalating conflict. And that's part of the practice, is identifying the different types of conflict, the different levels of conflict, learning when to intervene, how to intervene. But also every week we teach a meditation workshop because, you know, so much of nonviolence is about learning to let go of the internal violence that we carry within our own hearts. And so practices like meditation, practices like writing poetry, singing songs together, those types of practices are part of the strategy of nonviolence, of learning to release that internal violence so that when we're in situations of conflict and we're trying to create peace externally, that we're stepping into it from a place of peace internally as well.
Are those your personal practices as well? You mentioned poetry and meditation. Can you just give me a little bit about what empowers you to take this to create this external transformation in the world?
I'm talking to my meditation teacher at the East Bay Meditation Center, which is one of our core partners in this work, about designing a 1-day workshop on mindfulness and nonviolence, because we find that there's so many connections between the two. For me, you know, I just got back from a 10-day Vipassana course, and I'm headed to a 5-day course on Wednesday, and I find that to be a very helpful practice. Just, I mean, in so many ways, right? Just in terms of being able to release the internal pressures that we build up in our own daily lives, but also learning the mental discipline that it takes to stay committed to our focus and our path despite all of the distractions in our lives. And, you know, when we're in the prisons, we always talk about how, whether they're in the prisons or when they go home to their home communities, if their path is to create peace or to have a healthy family life or whatever it might be, there's going to be constant distractions around them, and they're going to need to find ways to be able to move forward despite those. So I find meditation to be a very helpful practice. But there's practices that, you know, I'm not much of a poet, so it's not something that I personally use, but there's practices that work for all of us, and what we encourage is for each person to find what works for them.
I want to move to a separate conversation here. When you spoke at a gathering we had at the Population Project, you spoke about this example of this having the semblance of peace at University of Alabama. Could you tell that story? Because I think I find it really important to the hidden suffering and oppression that exists. We're not forever the same society where so much so much injustice is outside of our view, and this idea of Thich Nhat Hanh has of looking deeply that into things that we can't direct experience without destruction.
Sure. I love that story too, and it really, just hearing that story for the first time changed my perspective on how I view peace, because I think, you know, we use terms like nonviolence and peace and even violence all the time without really talking about what it means. And so back in the days of the civil rights movement, there was a young woman named Autran Lucy who was the first black student ever enrolled in the University of Alabama on their campus in Tuscaloosa. And so you can imagine in the early 1950s, the first day that the first black student was walking around on campus, it was a very tense environment, and there was a lot of violence, and people were throwing stones at her, and someone burnt a cross, and they were breaking windows, and there was a lot of tension and a lot of violence. And so the school responded by kicking her out of the school. They expelled her. And they couldn't expel her because she was black anymore, so they said that your presence is causing a threat to the security of our school. We can't guarantee your safety, nor can we guarantee the safety of the rest of the campus, so you need to leave. So they expelled her. And the next day, the rioting had died down. There was no more violence in the campus anymore because she was no longer there. And a local newspaper ran a headline that said, Autran Lucy expelled. There is now peace on the campus of Tuscaloosa. And so Dr. King, in response to that incident, gave one of my favorite sermons that he ever spoke, and it's called When Peace Becomes Obnoxious. And in that sermon, he talked about how that was a false peace. He called it a negative peace, which was the absence of violence that was created through a layer of injustice. He said that that so-called peace came at the expense of justice for Autran Lucy, and therefore that was not a real peace, it was a negative peace. And it was in that sermon that he talked about how real peace is not simply the absence of a negative force like tension or violence or fear and confusion, but it's really the presence of a positive force like justice, love, compassion, and understanding. And if you don't have those things, what you have is a negative peace, and what he was working towards was what he called a positive peace, which is a peace with justice for all people. And so it's this understanding of peace as simply the absence of violence that allows us to justify going to war to create peace. Like if we kill all the violent people, then we'll have peace. Or, you know, being in Oakland, I always talk about if we lock up every single young person throughout Oakland, we would have less violence. But that is a whole different thing than trying to create peace. And so, you know, I think when we talk about wanting to create cultures of peace, we really have to look at, okay, so what does it mean to have justice for all the communities and all the parties involved in that?
Well, I'm wondering, so with that question, what does it look like? I'm reflecting on my work as an advocate for animals. And I think of how factory farming and different animal agriculture, there's a great deal of suffering that goes on into the confinement, the mutilation, slaughter of animals that's out of view from people. And I'm curious, I'm curious how your view of peace and justice and nonviolence, how you take that into situations where people are participating in systems of injustice, not knowing they're doing it, or very able to do it in a way that they can sort of say, I'm not causing this, that someone else is doing the harm. I'm just, it's not me. And I'm wondering, what is the role you think people play, you know, in that system and in other systems, and how we sort of, what is the role, what is our requirement of looking deeply, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, to things that are not so obvious, to where we're supporting these systems?
Right. One quick story that I thought of as you were saying that is several years ago, I was on The Longest Walk, which was a walk that was initiated by the American Indian Movement. And it was the second longest walk. The first one happened in 1978. It was the 25th anniversary. And so we were walking from California, San Francisco to Washington, D.C. And part of the call that the pilgrimage, the walk was putting out there is that all life is sacred. And I remember one day we were walking through the Central Valley of California, and apparently we were near some like chicken slaughter farm. And so, you know, there are 100 of us, 150 of us marching down the highway, and every 10 minutes or so we would see an 18-wheeler. And these 18-wheelers were just completely stacked to the top with crates and crates of just hundreds of chickens, hundreds. And every 10 minutes, these trucks would go by. And on the other side of the highway, every 10 minutes, these trucks would be going back the other way, and all of the crates were empty. And it was just this, like, I mean, it was a really, you know, here we are marching, calling for all life to be honored as something that is sacred, and then seeing these truckloads of chickens going one way and then these trucks that are empty going the other way was just such a, I guess, like cognitive dissonance, you know, and trying to make sense of it. But I think you're right that I think so often the people that are participating in those systems of injustice don't consciously understand that, and I think they don't always acknowledge the internal violence that is building up inside of them as those participating in those systems. And I think if you look at, you know, I'm not sure what the statistics might be for people who work in factory farms and things like that, but I do know that if you look at prison guards, they have some of the highest suicide rates, they have some of the highest domestic violence rates in their homes, alcoholism. If you look at soldiers returning from war, that there's more soldiers that commit suicide than ones that are actually killed during the war in the battlefield. And I think, you know, one of the, like, you know, I work in the prisons and I go there because I want to empower the prison inmates. And at the same time, I'm always acknowledging that we're also there for the guards because they're part of the system as much as anybody, and they're suffering as much as anybody because they're forced to be part of this unjust system, whether they acknowledge it or not. So I think, you know, like you were saying earlier about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I think nonviolence is really about acknowledging that we're all in pain and finding ways to heal all parties. Like Dr. King used to say that the civil rights movement wasn't an issue between black people and white people, but it was an issue between justice and injustice, and that it was an effort to save black people's bodies and white people's souls, because being a racist, being a segregationist destroys your soul from inside out, whether they acknowledge it or not.
Well, so I really connect to that about not being black versus white. It's about being anti-justice. There's a, I'm not sure who said it, but there's a famous quote that said, that says neutrality only helps the oppressed or never the oppressed. So I'm just curious about your take on, you know, when there are more clear lines about who, like an Oscar Grant case maybe, who is the oppressor and who is the oppressed, or in other situations, how does, you know, how does one help the oppressor and the oppressed, and what is it really special to take sides? Is it ever appropriate? And what is the side you take in a way, in that situation that doesn't, that acknowledge, that acknowledges the suffering that's created without being too Pollyanna about the fact that we love everyone and that everyone should just be happy?
Right. I mean, I think in nonviolence, we're always taking the side of justice and the side of truth and the side of freedom. And, you know, we always say that nonviolence is about defeating your opponent. It's about winning them over. When we go into the prisons, like I remember one time I was doing a 2-day workshop in a county jail, and I'm always very cognizant of the guards that are on duty watching us and the comments that I make and facilitating the dialogue that happens within the group. And there was one time at the end of the 2-day workshop that the deputy who was on duty came up to me after all the guys had gone back into their cells, and he kind of nudged me on my shoulder and was like, "Hey man, can I get a copy of that training manual that you were working off? Because I was really listening to what you were saying, and it makes a lot of sense, and I want to practice this with my family." And so I think, you know, when we talk about how to transform conflict situations, that's universal, whether we're talking to prison inmates or prison guards. And so I think there is a way to really work to empower both communities at the same time. And, you know, you look at, you know, because Hitler is a popular topic of conversation that comes up when in our workshops. And, you know, obviously when we say, like, one of the principles of nonviolence is attack forces of evil, not persons doing evil, and really acknowledging the forces behind any one individual and acknowledging the, like, how much humanity you have to lose in yourself in order to harm another person. And the more people you're harming, there's an old saying that says hurt people hurt people. And so the more people you're harming, you're only able to do that because you've lost touch with your own sense of humanity. And so having compassion for that. But also when we talk about, attacking forces of evil and that person's doing evil, that's not saying that we don't hold individuals accountable. I think part of justice needs to be holding people accountable for the harm that they have committed, but I think the question becomes, what does it mean to really hold somebody accountable? Like, does incarceration and punishment and treating someone like an animal, does that really hold them accountable? And I would argue it's actually the opposite of accountability. I don't think accountability is something that you can force on somebody. So I think it's important that we're not, that we're attacking systems and behaviors and cultures and not individual people. And I think it's critical for our society, for our communities, to find ways to hold people accountable that keeps them embraced in our community.
Well, on that question of accountability, and so there's the oppressed, or the people fighting for justice are asking to hold the oppressors or those who are perpetuating systems of injustice. I'm curious, do you have any concrete examples or memories of situations where those who were the oppressors or perpetuating systems of injustice were transformed, and what were the key ingredients that allowed that to happen?
I'm a big advocate for restorative justice, which is a tradition that mostly comes out of the Maori people, who are the indigenous people of New Zealand. And the juvenile justice system of New Zealand has taken on the practice of restorative justice, and it's also becoming more and more popular in the United States as well. I have some criticisms about the way it's being implemented in a lot of schools in the United States, but I think overall the idea is that, the part of the problem that I have with the criminal justice system that we have today in this country is that both the perpetrator of the crime as well as the victim, or in restorative justice language, the author of the incident and the recipient of the incident, are bystanders in a system that doesn't include their voice. Whereas in a restorative system, the perpetrator and the victim are the key voices. You bring all of the people that have been impacted by that incident together so that collectively those people can decide how best to move forward. And I think part of what that allows is to both honor the pain of the quote-unquote perpetrator and whatever situations and circumstances they were going through, but also for that person to hear directly from the other people that they impacted. And to, because I think you can only hold yourself accountable, and you can only hold yourself accountable if you can own the actions that you did and the impact that that had on the community. And I think in a criminal justice system where it makes you so defensive because you're fighting for your life because you don't want to go to prison, it's really hard to just sit with what you did and own what you did. And so I think in a restorative approach, it includes the voices of the most impacted people and is able to honor each person's perspective and creates a space where each person can own the role that they played in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're running low on time. My last question while we get the Q&A set up is, one of the things that you, your mentor said, and Martin Luther King said, is he wanted to internationalize and institutionalize nonviolence. For the people on this call, I'm wondering what you suggest that we can, what actions we can take in our life. These are mostly people grounded already in meditation and other practices. What can we take in the world that would make that dream a reality?
So the idea of institutionalizing and internationalizing nonviolence, which was came out of a conversation that Dr. King had with my mentor just about 5 hours before he was shot, is that the practices of nonviolence isn't just about how we protest, but it's about how we relate to each other in our own lives and in our own communities, and that we can take these principles and embed them as part of the day-to-day practice in institutions around the country and around the world. And so part of our dream is, what would it look like to embed the practices of nonviolence and conflict reconciliation as part of the core curriculum of every school across America, so that as we're teaching children the math and the sciences and the arts, we're also teaching them how to relate to each other as human beings. And so I think in terms of the goal of institutionalizing and internationalizing nonviolence and practices like meditation, there's so many amazing organizations that are really trying to do that work, to get into the schools, to get into the prisons, to get into law enforcement agencies, to work in your workspaces, communities of faith, to really make sure that these practices are being embedded as part of the day-to-day practice. Because like I said, it's one thing to you know, come to a two-day workshop in nonviolence, but it's a whole other thing to take it on as a way of life, similar to a martial arts or a sport where you have to really practice it every single day in order to improve. So I think by finding ways to embedding it, by finding ways to embed the practice in whatever institutions and communities that you're a part of, so it becomes a much more intentional part of our day-to-day growth and learning, I think that's part of how we, over the long term, are going to be able to change cultures.
Well, thank you, Kazu. I guess, Konstantin, you're, I guess, the first, whoever wants to do the first Q&A.
Hi, this is Matthew.
Yeah,
can you hear?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, great. Well, first, thank you, Kazu and Ari, for this interesting discussion. Kazu, you mentioned taking on the practice of nonviolence as a way of life, not just taking, you know, a several-day workshop, but continuing with it on an ongoing basis. And you had mentioned institutions. What? And you also previously mentioned a Kingian nonviolence workshop. What are some options for formally studying this topic of nonviolence? For me, I'm particularly curious about nonviolent conflict resolution as well as mediation. What are your thoughts and suggestions on how to study it in a formal setting as well as on an ongoing basis?
As far as formal settings, if you look on our website, eastpointpeace.org, not only, you know, there's lists of obviously our upcoming workshops, but on our resources page, there's a list of a lot of other organizations that are offering trainings in things like nonviolence and restorative justice. And I think that there's a lot of opportunities to do those formal studies. You know, informally, you know, nonviolence is sometimes as simple as greeting your neighbor with a smile. And I think those little things really do add up to the ongoing practice of nonviolence.
Thank you so much. Kazu, I was just curious to know, my parents are visiting right now, and you know how it is. It's on the... So I was just wondering, sometimes I think it's easier to deal with conflict or situations, you know, outside of your own family or people you're close to, because you can actually take a step back and, you know, be non-judgmental as much as you can. I mean, but how do you, like, deal with conflicts with, and they're not even real conflicts, I mean, it's, but just that the underlying history and the negative thoughts and feelings that you have, which sometimes you're not able to express them as clearly as you would in a situation like a mediation or, you know. So how do you personally kind of deal with your family or more personal situations?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. You know, I think even when you look at quote-unquote great people like Dr. King, Dr. King was an amazing activist and an amazing leader and was not always an amazing family man. And I think we all struggle with that, and those are places where we all need to improve. And I think in my own life, you know, it's absolutely the same way. The last 2 years has been a really, really contentious time for my family, and we've been going through a lot of difficult times. And I think in some ways the challenges that my family members have been facing in their lives has really brought us together, because, you know, like we've been saying, conflict is an opportunity for us to come together. And I'm really proud in some ways of the way that I've been able to contribute to my family during these difficult times. And I think what I'm struggling with now is how I can continue to contribute to my family and to contribute to the growth of my family when times aren't difficult. Because even when times aren't quote not difficult, there is sometimes a sense of that negative piece, right? There's a lot of stuff that all families have gone through in our past that maybe we hold some negative emotions and negative feelings about that we're not able to bring up and discuss. And I think nonviolence is not about avoiding conflict. It's about learning to confront conflict in a healthy way. And so one of the things that my family and I have discussed, even though we're far apart geographically, is a weekly Skype call where we intentionally have those difficult discussions. And I think sometimes when you just clearly lay out the intention that, okay, we're going to like have some difficult discussions. And I think if that's the understanding up front, it kind of eases it a little bit. And I think just, you know, and it's, like I said, with anything, like it's a lifelong process to learn, but I think it's really important that, especially, you know, I'm Japanese, and so in my culture, we're not used to having difficult discussions. We're told to just suck it up, right, and hold it in and let it fester inside, and that's the honorable thing to do. And that's a cultural thing, but I think those are part of, that's one of the things about a lot of our cultures that need to change, and that we need to be more comfortable with having those difficult discussions.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Kazu. Hi.
I'm wondering, as we wait for another caller, Kazu, that one of the key tenets that I find supports me is the idea of bringing acceptance to situations as they are. And you brought up anger as being a motivating force, which comes from a lot of times not accepting the situation as it is. I'm curious about, like, when is acceptance a fertile ground for understanding, and when can it lead to passivity and indifference to injustice?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that last bit?
When does acceptance sort of become the fertile ground for reconciliation and understanding to create a greater peace? And when is it, what is the pitfalls about it sometimes leading to passivity and or indifference to allowing things systems of injustice to maintain themselves?
Sure. I think Dr. King Dr. King was actually critical of a lot of pacifist movements. And he was saying that oftentimes we misunderstand what true pacifism means, and a lot of pacifists falsely understand pacifism as non-resistance to evil, whereas true pacifism is about non-violent resistance to evil, and those are very different things. And I think when it comes to situations of injustice and violence and oppression, that to be passive and to not resist doesn't help change anything. And I think nonviolence is about learning to resist, but learning to resist through love, and learning and understanding the power that love has to transform situations. And so I think it's, you know, the anger is such a tricky thing, because I think we need to learn to honor what Dr. King talked a lot about honoring our righteous indignation, that we need to be angry about the situations, but we have to learn to channel that anger in a proper way so that it doesn't burn us out, and that we're intentional about being angry at the injustice and not the individuals that are caught up in the injustice. I think Dr. King was very clear that when it comes to situations of injustice and violence, that being passive and accepting it is not the answer, but it's learning to confront it through the forces of love.
Mm. Thank you, Kazu. Hi, 917-238.
Sure. Hi, everyone. This is Versha calling.
Hi, Versha.
Hi. I actually had a couple of questions. One was related to budgets. I mean, I don't know if domestically we have a budget for prioritizing nonviolence in terms of curriculum for schools, like we have for art and music and a lot of other creative activities. And I know there have been times where those budgets have been cut. I don't know if you can address that in any way in terms of your city, Oakland, or state. And the other question was regarding points of time where maybe being silent or still or just being is more conducive or is a smarter move than including maybe walking away from a conflict or situation, if you can address that as well.
As far as budgets, I don't know the details of federal budgets. I mean, certainly there's not a huge effort put into it. Locally in Oakland, there is a small budget to implement restorative justice in the school systems. But this is one of the areas where I was saying I'm somewhat critical of the way it's being implemented, because I don't think they're, you know, healing conflict and healing trauma and bringing practices like nonviolence and restorative justice in a community like Oakland is not an easy task. And I feel like part of our work, especially when working with young people in a place like Oakland where there's so much violence and trauma, is, you know, using things like nonviolence and restorative justice to help heal wounds. And I think that's a really, really tricky thing, that if you're going to work with young people who carry so much trauma and you're going to open up those wounds, then the people that open up those wounds has to be able to hold that space in a way that honors that pain and it happens in a way that we're able to close those wounds back up. And I think oftentimes the way restorative justice is implemented in the schools is we take a bunch of teachers who have no knowledge of restorative justice practices and oftentimes have no connection to the young people that they're working with in any real way. And we put them for 2-day training and we say, okay, go heal them. Go open up these wounds and go have these difficult discussions. And I think that actually has a tendency to do more harm than good. And so I think, you know, if we're going to put resources behind these practices, and we need to do it really mindfully and intentionally and not just throw a couple dimes and nickels here and there, but really invest heavily into it. You know, I'm of the opinion that we're not going to see peace in our culture until we are investing just as heavily into peace as we do into war. And so we are nowhere near that. And I think that's something that we need to struggle for. And I think in terms of walking away from conflict, I think, you know, each conflict is different. And there may be times, because one of the things that I found in my own personal life is the goal in any conflict is to reconcile. That is the ultimate goal in every conflict if you're committed to the practice of nonviolence. And I acknowledge that reconciliation is not something you can force on a person. And that if they're not ready for that, then sometimes the best thing you can do is to walk away from that conflict and let that other person know that the door for reconciliation is always open whenever they're ready for it. So I think, you know, sometimes you can try to force reconciliation to a point where it might actually escalate the conflict if the other side isn't ready. And I think sometimes there are spaces for you to push and almost force a process of reconciliation. I think if you look at the civil rights movement or Gandhi's independence movement, that was an effort at forcing dialogue and forcing negotiation and forcing reconciliation when the country wasn't ready for it. So I think, you know, it's a tricky thing, and that's why it takes so much practice and training to really be able to see when is the right time to push and when is the right time to push back or to sit back.
Thank you. Vina?
Hi, it's Vina here again. Firstly, thank you so much. I found this conversation very valuable. Secondly, I'm going to be naughty and comment before I question. And the comment is in response to Kunshan's question about family. It happens that I am with my family now in Chicago, so I'm not normally based here. I'm usually the source of a lot of conflict, just arguing and all sorts of things when I come here. And I've noticed, despite you know, in the outside world being a mediator and all of that, yeah, you get me with my family and it just all goes away. This trip, however, has not been like that. And it's been getting better with each trip. And what's been really valuable, just to add to what Kazu was saying, about having difficult conversations is what I really embedding a practice that I refreshed through some training I went through last week of being present and choosing inquiry over assumption. And so I often find that I get into conflict, particularly with my family, when I have all these stories built up in me, and often they're very, very old when it comes to family, and then I choose to be led by the stories. And then all the assumptions that go with the stories. And so then I blurt out whatever comes to mind from that perspective, rather than asking a question. And so this trip, there has been practically no, not there hasn't been conflict, it hasn't escalated. I mean, there's been conflict in my mind, or I'd be tense, or someone's tense, but it hasn't, peace has emerged through taking a path of inquiry over assumption and judgment. So I just wanted to throw that out there. the question that I have is, I'm based in New Mexico right now, and I'm doing work with a lot of artists that promote social justice. And in your in the definition of peace that we've been talking about here, which I really value, the distinction between pacifism and passivism, as it were, and the word justice, we use it a lot, and I understand why. In these groups I'm working with in Santa Fe, we're actually deliberating sort of the language of social justice because it's starting to almost work against us in some contexts. So I'm wondering if you've encountered, like, if Kazu or anyone's encountered sort of, it's almost like this backlash, even amongst progressive people. They hear the word justice and people get tense or something. And we're wondering, you know, do we continue? We think we're promoting and pursuing social justice. We're conscious that that language somehow seems to close people down. And so I'm wondering what's your definition of justice? And also if you've experienced something similar to that. I don't actually have a specific concrete example. If you've experienced something similar to that, how you've responded to it.
I personally haven't experienced any kind of reaction to the term justice in my work. I do often have and continue to. Sometimes people have a hesitation to terminology like peace warrior, or, you know, Dr. King talked about the nonviolent army, and Gandhi talked about the Shanti Sena, and the East Point Peace Academy, even, right? And comparing our work to the military. So I do experience that, and I think a lot of our work is really about reclaiming language in a way, and because even nonviolence, the term nonviolence has been misunderstood by so many people, and it's such a loaded term. And the two people that created the curriculum of Kingian nonviolence actually debated for about 2 days about whether or not to call it nonviolence, because it is such a loaded term and a misunderstood term. And other nonviolent activists like Diane Nash from the civil rights movement no longer uses the term nonviolence. She calls it agapic energy. But I think for us, it's a really important term because it ties us with a legacy of nonviolence. And I think terms like justice also connects us to a long legacy of movements. And I think for me, that's really important because that's one of the things that I really struggle with a lot of the people that were active in the Occupy movement, is there was almost the sense that Occupy discovered the art of organizing. Mm-hmm. And we stand on the shoulders of so many that came before us. Mm-hmm. And the Occupy movement is a continuing legacy of the civil rights movement, which is a continuing legacy of Gandhi's movement. And so I think it's important to maintain legacy, and I think language helps us connect with that legacy. Was there a second part to that question?
If you had to define justice,
right,
social justice, how would you define it?
Dr. King talked about justice in the context of balance, that the level of violence that we see in our communities today, in our world today, is a sign that the world is out of balance. Mm. And our effort is to try to bring the world back into balance. And so as extreme as the violence is out there, we have to be just as extreme in our nonviolence to try to bring things back into balance.
Mm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. Hi. Sorry, it was 760.
Yeah, good morning. This is Margarita.
Hi, Margarita.
Hi. I just wanted to thank everyone for just the beautiful way to start my Saturday. And I'm just going to ask the question first. I just want to know from Kazu, what is your personal daily routine to keep your peace? I come from a point where I believe that peace starts with me. And as a human being, we are always struggling in our minds with just the opposites, just like you said, justice and injustice, peace and war, black and white. So it's a constant struggle. So if peace starts with me, again, what is your personal daily routine to keep your peace?
So I think the first thing I need to acknowledge is that I struggle with it, like we all do. We're all imperfect human beings trying to improve every day. And my schedule tends to be very hectic, and I travel a lot. And when I travel, I tend to fall out of routines. So I'm trying to actually kind of reorganize my work a little bit, so I'm doing less travel and I'm home a little bit more. But I think for me, my meditation practice is definitely a very important part of that. I think most people on this call have a meditation practice, it seems like. And you notice the days when you don't meditate. For me, I notice when I don't meditate, I notice it the next day, how stressful I am and how easier it is for me to get agitated. So that's a part of it. I think eating healthy and exercising, which are two things that, again, in my hectic schedule sometimes fall off the radar. Those are two important things. Spending time with family, making sure that I'm connected to my family in a way, even if they're far away. I think those are all part of, my practice that help me get through the day a little bit. But, I struggle with it. I struggle maintaining. I enjoy the time that, like when I'm at a meditation retreat, or back when I was younger, when I lived in those temples, because there were structures in place that allowed me to maintain those routines. And when I'm outside of those structures, I oftentimes struggle. So I think also just finding places where those structures exist, going to the East Bay Meditation Center every week, or going to, regular Vipassana courses and things like that to help me maintain those routines.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Ari. That's the key. I feel that too. Being in those environments, it's much easier. But when you're away, then that's where the real struggle begins. Thank you so much for this wonderful, wonderful conversation, Kazu. I was wondering, what can we as a community do to support your work? As service-based, as all the people on the call who will be sent a mail after this call, and we'll write a blog and also post up the audio to spread the good work that you're doing. But we would love to know what we can do to support you in your work.
Thank you. Our work on a micro level, if everyone can go to our website, eastpointpeace.org, and just learn more about our work and maybe attend the workshop in the future. I'm going to be posting this on our website later today, but we've just been nominated for the Community Choice Award from the San Francisco Foundation. And so there's a voting process, and if we win, we get a small grant, or actually a pretty significant grant. And, our organization is a tiny, tiny organization. So each grant that we get is very significant. So I'll be posting that information on our website later on today. So that would be helpful if people can spread the word about that. But also on a macro level, our work is not our organization's work, but it's the work of our communities. And so I think anything that people can do to spread the messages of love and nonviolence and compassion, and really continue to make sure that the legacies of Dr. King doesn't die with that bullet, and the legacy of Gandhi doesn't die with that bullet, and that we're keeping these legacies alive and acknowledging that all of our work stands on their shoulders. I think, all of that helps our work on a macro level, and I think it's important to think about it that way as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm handing it back to Ari so he gets an opportunity to conclude the call, and then we will again do a minute of silence. Like we started, we can end with a minute of silence. So over to you, Ari.
Thank you, Kanchan. Well, right now I'm just feeling a lot of gratitude for the time spent together. I feel a greater insight around what about conflict, what it means to have conflict, what's justice and what's really false forms of justice and peace. And better integration about how my self-transformation meets the external transformation in systems of injustice around the world. And also a lot of gratitude for for how you show up in the world, Kazu, and your commitment to supporting a more kind, compassionate, connected, and just world. So thank you very much for not just for this phone call, and for sharing your work, but also in the broader scale for the work you're doing in the world and what you've been doing since you were 17 years old. And I wish you great success in your path for the benefit of all beings.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on the call.
Yeah, and with that, I'll pass it back to Kanchan.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So let's all close the call in a minute of silence, after which I will unmute everyone and you will get an opportunity to shout out your thank yous to Kazu. So we'll do this minute of silence and deep gratitude for all the work that Kazu is doing and all the other wonderful souls who are doing work to make everybody's life better. And we'll just send some positive energy to everyone and also keep the elders, like Prakash was mentioning, in our hearts, who've led us and given us direction so far. So I just request a minute of silence, after which I will unmute everyone. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. So at the count of three, we can all thank Kazu. One, two, three. Thank you, Kazu.
Thank you all.
Thank you,
Kazu. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ari. Thank you, Kanchan.
Thank you, Ari. Thank you, everyone, for joining.
Thank you, Kanchan.
Bye.
Thank you all. Take care.